All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome, welcome one and all to episode 40 of the episode 40. I don't know why I just repeated myself twice, but it's still the SLS Cast. Episode 40. I cannot believe that we now not only have something in common with Over the Hill people, but also South Dakota and OCD people. Go ahead, Tim. Ask me how that's possible.
Well, how is it possible? What's so significant about 40 with OCD people?
You see, 40 is the only number whose letters are in alphabetical order. Moreover, South Dakota was the 40th state admitted to the Union.
It all makes sense.
As well it should. As well it should. So I am the eldest co-host, Matt.
The eldest co-host?
Well, I'm older than you.
I am the child of the...
the man-child.
Duet. The man-child of the duet. Tim.
There are some who call me... Tim?
The other guy.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. So... Well, I'm feeling like crap, and my week was pretty just busy with stupid crap, and nothing adventurous happened to me. So let's just go with you and your sliced-up tongue, and you can tell us about your week.
Yeah, I do have a sliced-up tongue. Let's see, I had a friend come over and visit from Houston, did the whole hanging out thing, and I decided once I picked him up from LAX, I was going to take him over to Santa Monica, because Santa Monica was not quite a hop, skip, and a jump, because nothing in Los Angeles is a hop, skip, and a jump. So it was more of like a just hitting every goddamn light between LAX and Santa Monica. It was kind of annoying. But anyways, we get there, we find a place to park, and, you know, I look at the parking structure, and it's P5 in that area. There's like six or seven different parking areas, big parking structures, and what I noticed parking there is that this one was actually pretty small. So I thought, okay, well, since this one is smaller than all the other ones, you know, this should help me remember which parking structure I parked at and where it's located. So we go off, we go eat British food. You know, it was tasty, and I felt very pompous and showed him the pier, which is kind of awkward when you're, you know, holding a beer, walking around the pier where there's little kids playing, and you think it'd just be cool to go there, but no, it's just actually kind of creepy. Sitting there and watching the kids riding the Ferris wheel. And it's actually a real Ferris wheel. It's kind of smaller than a real Ferris wheel, but anyways. So we get back, and we either wait 45 minutes to go up to a rooftop bar, and who knows, maybe we can only get wine there, and we were in a beer mood, or maybe we're not even planning on staying for even 5 minutes up there. So there's really no point of waiting anywhere in Santa Monica for 45 minutes. We just decided, well, let's go back to the car. Let's head over to Sunset. He likes to go to this place called, whenever he visits, called Rainbow Bar and Grill. That's a famous place off of Sunset Boulevard where all the rock and rollers used to go. Alice Cooper used to hang out there. Ron Jeremy hangs out there a lot. Lemmy. So he's like, yeah, sure, yeah, let's go there. It'd be fun. Drink a few brews and carry on the evening there. So then we start off on the trek to locate my car. And I will tell you that I've never spent close to an hour searching for my car ever in my lifetime. Actually, for anybody's car, you know, it was just insane. We go exactly in the direction where we were supposed to. Once we went kind of like 5 blocks out and stopping and saying, well, you know, something feels a little bit wrong. I don't think we actually walked this far to get to where we needed to go. We just kept going, and eventually we turned back around and took forever to find our car. Eventually we found our car, again, about an hour later. By this time we were about to give up, and it was one of those things where, you know, bars close at 2. We have about 2 hours to get back, so we're there for about an hour and a half to hang out and drink, have fun, do whatever. But by the time we got to the car, we only had an hour to get there and an hour to actually drink and be merry and do whatever. So we get in the car and we start driving off, and I thought, well, I was going to take him down the scenic route before, but this time I'm just going to get on the 405, get off at Sunset, and boom, be there in about 10-15 minutes. Perfect. Well, I get down 45, and of course you start seeing the big red flashing lights saying, you know, in the signs, construction, warning, construction on so-and-so's city. What would be the odds that Sunset Boulevard would be closed on a Friday night at midnight for construction? The odds were not in our favor. In fact, every single exit that we could have taken to get to where we wanted to go was closed. So to all of you guys that don't know anything about the atrocious freeway system in LA, it's basically 405 takes you way the hell out of where you need to be. It doesn't matter where you're wanting to go, the 405 takes you away from it. So if you're stuck on the 405 going in one direction, you're going out of the way, regardless of where you're going. And then you get on the 101. And the 101 is kind of like the icing on the cake, because it loops you around. Ranting aside, we finally got there, and we had about maybe 30 minutes to drink a few drinks, hang out, and carry on with our evening. However, to make up for it, we were visited by every man's best friend. Mr. Ron Jeremy was at the bar. So we spent our closing evening at the bar with Ron Jeremy. Well, I wouldn't really say that made up for anything. Are you a fan of Ron Jeremy's? Would you have been starstruck if you saw him sitting next to you? Or would you just thought like, oh my God, what are you putting in your mouth this time?
I would have to say that I'd never got to see his early work. He is a generation removed from me in that regard. But I have seen some, because I was always like, well, what's the big deal? He seems like a long-haired, heavy-set dude, but chicks seem to dig him because he was a porn star or something. And turns out he was actually pretty good-looking back in the day. He was pretty, you know, built and everything, so that's how he got his thing. Other than that, he's just learned how to capitalize on himself. So I don't hate him for having a career, I just kind of think it sucks that he can get chicks and that we can't just because of something he did 30 years ago. I don't know, it's kind of weird. I'd probably treat him like a normal human being, though. It's been my modus operandi every time I have ever met up with a famous person of any form or fashion.
I just don't think I could actually shake his hand. Because of like all the stuff, you know, all the things it might have touched.
But if he stopped using lady-scented body wash and switched to Old Sex, the body wash that smells like three-day-old stale sex, he could smell like me.
Like, oh, literally.
I don't know. There's tons of hot chicks that have touched him, though. So, you know, if you're going to...
Wait, that touched
route.
Tim or him?
Well, both ways. You know, you're kind of doing that. And if you're that worried about it, I mean, it's not like you can't go grab the Purell or something. No worse than touching a dollar bill. And everybody does that.
Unless it's a crisp dollar bill. Like a fresh one right out of the plastic. If that is where they keep dollar bills.
Indeed.
This is exciting.
Yeah. All right, should we go ahead and do the dirty work here?
Yes, sir.
All right, let's get on with the news. The news. Ooh. Man, I'm surprised I was able to get that out.
Genie, please don't be upset with me. You have your health. Be thankful.
But I made it through. Yes, the news. The news, the news, the news. All right, so first up, we've got some announcements from Marvel here, Marvel, courtesy of Marvel.com. We've got some release dates here. Are you ready? Here we go. We've got Thor, The Dark World, coming out on November 8th. Next up, we've got Captain America, The Winter Soldier, coming in spring 2014. Go figure. That's coming out April 4th, 2014. We've got Guardians of the Galaxy heading to us on August 1st, 2014. Then we get Avengers, Age of Ultron, on May 1st, 2015, and last but certainly not least, Ant-Man, on July 31st, 2015. You'd think they'd kind of do those flip-flopped if Ant-Man has a chance of being in the next Avengers movie. I don't know, maybe they're just going to set him up in the Avengers movie. Ah, that's kind of weird.
Oh, he's not going to be in the next Avengers movie.
What's
he
that?
Won't be. He will not be in Avengers 2.
Oh, okay, well, there you go. So, what the fuck do I know? I just work on a podcast about movies. I should probably not know these things. All right. Next up, coming to us from Deadline.com, from the Deadline team, Universal sets Jurassic World release date of June 12th, 2015. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Universal Pictures will release Jurassic World in 3D on June 12th, 2015. Steven Spielberg is producing the big-budget dino sequel, formerly known as Jurassic Park 4. Colin Trevorrow directs from a draft of a screenplay he wrote with Derek Connolly, Frank Marshall, and Pat Crowley are producing. So there you go. Two exciting bits of news from different parts of the movie universe. So we've got the superhero stuff coming, and then we've got the dinosaurs coming. Imagine if we had dinosaur superheroes. Which, depending on who you want to listen to about the Transformers 4 movie, you might actually get, because there's some talk of the dinosaur Transformers being in the next one. That's all rumor stuff right now, until I can get something confirmed from the various sites that I frequent.
That's bizarre. That's a little too much right there.
I know, I will.
A Jurassic Park Transformers crossover?
Well, it's not a direct crossover. There were Dinobots.
Right, and yeah, that's what the next Transformers movie is going to be. It's going to include Dinobots.
Well, I haven't seen anything confirmed on that. They've hinted
at
it.
It is confirmed.
Who confirmed it?
I think the tagline kind of gives it away, and also Michael Bay came out and said there will be Dinobots.
Okay, well, there you go. That was the one thing I was holding back on. I wasn't. Because I had seen the tagline, but again, what I read was from Yahoo, and it said it was rumored that that was the tagline. So I wasn't going to come out and say it for sure. But hey, if you're telling us that Michael Bay has said it, the man of the explosion, I guess then it should be it. And there you go. Next up, I've got two pieces of news left. This comes to us from thedissolve.com, courtesy of Vadim Rizov. It turns out that Kodak's back in action and making film stock again. That's right, folks. As of September 3rd, 2013, Kodak officially emerged from bankruptcy, returning to operation as a business primarily interested in packaging, graphics, communications, and functional printing. Translation, they've put a lot of money into proprietary commercial printing technology, touchscreens, and the like. However, turns out that celluloid stock will still be part of the restructured company's plans. President of Kodak's Entertainment and Commercial Film Division told Variety that Kodak had created two new archival film stocks last year. Except the problem was, with the company in the middle of bankruptcy, nobody wanted to try it out. They didn't want to risk getting invested into it and then nobody being able to make it anymore. And Andrew Evensky, who is the president of Entertainment and Commercial Film Division, says, quote, "We're viable again, so I'm hopeful the studios will take another look at film and archiving," end quote. It's kind of interesting. Basically, the article does talk about how 75% of the world's screens, as of the end of last year, had converted to digital. There are tons of markets still in Central and South America that have not switched yet, and that's where they're looking to drive it primarily. But the coolest part is that it's the actual archival side. And as you and I have discussed before, Tim, that's turning into a really big thing, even though, regardless of where we had looked at it from the perspectives of, is digital better than film, it doesn't matter. You've still got to, for archival purposes, you've still got to have something to film that you can convert to digital. And this is going to be a real nice niche market for them. Although, I think it'd be really cool if they're going to be doing this, if one of the film stocks is, if maybe they could figure out a way to just say, hey, studios, send us your digital prints and we'll make drive-in movie film.
Ooh. That's right. Sounds good.
But it's like that taste. I'm sorry?
I like that taste.
Yeah.
Whatever that means.
It's also kind of interesting, though, because there are still purposes for film. The article does say that not many people noticed that this year's The Incredible Burt Wonderstone was shot on film. Then again, not many people noticed the movie, period. But director Don Scardino had a good explanation for why the studio allowed being shot on film. As he explained to Collider, digital's great for exterior night scenes because it needs so little light, but it gets washed out easily in harsh light. As a result, quote, "You spend a lot of time trying to light a scene, and digitally you spend a lot of time trying to knock light down," end quote. With a movie heavy on magic show sets with lots of black and red, two colors digital doesn't handle well, quote, "They did a budget, and they discovered that it would be no cheaper to shoot digitally," end quote. In other words, there's still a place for celluloid, even on pedestrian productions.
And did you know that Quentin Tarantino had come out and said that the day that he is unable to shoot a movie on film is the day that he retires? So I guess this is a good sign. This is a glimmer of hope that we will at least have Quentin Tarantino for another 10 years or so.
I kind of look at that like an empty threat for two reasons. One, I don't believe him. That's number one and most important. I don't believe him. But two, there's no real way we're ever going to test that theory. And that's why I don't believe him, because there's no way to test this theory. He is at a point in his career that no matter how bad any of his movies are going forward, he will probably always be able to negotiate to use film.
But not if it's not being made, he wouldn't be able to.
That's kind of like saying there's no reason to own a VCR today, except for the fact that there is a reason to own a VCR today. There are tons of people, even in our age group, 25 to 40, who were in that transitionary period where people were still using VHS camcorders and stuff. And so they're going to want to watch that. Also, there's a huge underground market, not a black market, but it's an underground market for VHS because of original production stills, stuff like that, that you can only get with those VHSs. So even now, when it's safe to say that VHS, quote, died nearly 20 years ago. Well, it was in its death throes 20 years ago. But it's been virtually dead for 15 years. Even today, it's not without merit to say you could still use a VHS player.
Well, that is correct. But with everything being transferred digitally for the sake of, well, your VHS tape might break or the film might warp, you always have that digital copy. So I think once people start making the change to a more I use reliable loosely because I personally think film is more reliable than digital, then there will be no reason to have tape or film. And that's why I think that in the future, well, actually maybe a couple years ago when the whole big digital boom with, man, I watched this great interview. It had Peter Jackson. Oh, damn. What's his name? James Cameron. Quentin Tarantino was there. Edgar Wright was there. And maybe one other director. I can't remember. I don't remember if George Lucas was there or not, but they were all talking about the future of digital. Of course, James Cameron came out and said, well, right now we're all going for special effects, and 3D is, at the time, was, you know, everything, you know, was, it's going to be in 3D, everybody's going to be sucked into this virtual world in the future, and that will be the next movie-going experience. And there will be no place for film. And that's when Quentin Tarantino said, I will always shoot on film. I cannot see myself ever shooting digitally because I like being able to hold the product in my hand. It's kind of like the same reason why people like records opposed to MP3s is because they like holding the actual mass of what they're using.
But that proves my point. Cassettes, which is really where the shift away from records came from, is 37 years old and was popularized 27 years ago and basically became the mainstay, and easily 20 years ago was gone because it had been eclipsed at that point by the birth of the CD. And now here we are 20 years later from the birth of the CD, and we're now into MP3s, and yet we still can go to a shop where you can get vinyl. It's going to be the same thing. That's why I say it's an empty threat. But there's going to be a way for him to make any movie he wants on film for the next, till he's dead. It's never going to go away completely. He'll be dead before they stop using film altogether. Will most likely be dead before that happens.
But the thing with vinyl is that vinyl has not made a comeback. It's not making a comeback whatsoever.
It's not, but it's still a niche market.
It kind of is, yes. But it's still like, look at the demand of it. Is considerably less than it was 20, 30 years ago.
Absolutely.
And each and every year, in each and every decade, the demand is going to go lower and lower and lower. And I'm not saying that Quentin Tarantino was going to be retiring in the next couple years. I bet Quentin Tarantino has buildings full of film stock for him to use in the future. But I'm talking about maybe in 20 years, when things might be completely digitally. However, I do think, and I do hope, that film does continue to be made. And I'm glad to hear about Kodak doing this, because they are a name brand and the leading maker of film stock,
yeah,
or the leading producer of
film
stock.
Here's the thing. I'm glad Kodak emerged from bankruptcy. I am a very old-fashioned guy in that regard. I like to see the pioneers stay out there. I don't want to see them go away. That being said, they deserved every stinking bit of misfortune that they got, because these motherfuckers invented digital photography in like 1973. Okay, invented it and then shelved the technology because they were afraid it would put them out of business. What happened? Yeah, they invented the technology and then shelved it because they were worried that instead of going from then and giving themselves 40 years to develop, market, and shift the technology themselves and own the globe, they got scared and it cost them. And now here they are today. So I don't really feel bad for them in that regard, but I am glad that they're back.
I like how the review was it turned out to be a big F you to Kodak by the end of it.
Just in this regard. But I have to say that, like you, I don't want film to go away in its entirety, because I think there will always be something to be said for shooting on film versus shooting on digital. However, that's not to say that you should ignore digital entirely. I don't want to hash all that out again. So, long story short, Kodak's back. They got film stock. Let's hope people use it. Moving along. From Yahoo Movies, this is my last piece of news. This is Yahoo.com from Yahoo Movies, courtesy of Mark Deming. Looks like we're going to be seeing John Leguizamo. That's right, that dude that played the farty-ass smelly clown in Spawn.
Ooh, what? Hey, easy with that face of me. Oops. Oh, what? What? I hope I didn't stain my underwear. Look at that. Skid marks.
Get away from me, you freak.
Yeah, that's him. He's going to actually be able to play Pablo Escobar. Now, I am a huge John Leguizamo fan. However, I did not see this coming. This is a man who literally went out of his way. He wanted this role so bad that he got with the director of the movie, and it's King of Cocaine. He actually got with him because he wanted the role so badly, and he actually knew the director. The director is Brad Furman, also who is known for The Lincoln Lawyer, and also Ben Affleck's next film, which is called Runner Runner. Once Leguizamo found out that he was going to direct King of Cocaine, Leguizamo said, I got to get this role. Well, studios didn't want him because they didn't think he was a big enough box office draw. They went after Oscar Isaac, but unfortunately, or I guess fortunately for Mr. Leguizamo, Isaac had to drop out of the project. Leguizamo says, fine, this is my one shot, I got to take it. And what he did was he got with Furman, and he went and spent, get this, $15,000 of his own money, and went and did the makeup, got all the prosthetics done and everything, and then shot a screen test with Furman helping to direct the test. They showed it to the producer first. They showed it to Scott Steindorf, and he was still wary, but after initially saying no, Furman persuaded him to show Leguizamo's test to two of Relativity's top executives, Tucker Tooley and Ryan Kavanaugh. And what they did was they showed Leguizamo's screen test against side-by-side footage of Escobar. And they didn't tell them who the actor was. Everybody said, yep, this guy's good. Then they said, oh yeah, that's John Leguizamo.
It would have been hysterical if they said, oh yeah, it's Eddie Murphy.
Yeah, doing the bus thing again. And it's kind of funny because it was a similar thing that got Audrey Meadows cast in The Honeymooners. She was too pretty. Jackie Gleason said, no, I'm sorry, Audrey Meadows is too pretty. She can't play my wife. So when she found out that that's what they thought of her headshots and everything, and that was the only reason she didn't get the part, she called a friend of hers who was a photographer and then went down to her house, stripped down into just basic plain clothes, washed her makeup off, put her hair up in a bun and put a couple of dirt streaks on, and had some new headshots taken and pictures of her doing housework, and sent that back. And Johnny Gleason said, man, this chick's amazing, get her. It's just interesting how people have gotten parts this way. But at any rate, I'm excited. I like John Leguizamo, so I am hoping that this role goes very well for him.
You know how hard this place is to find in the dark? It's times like these I appreciate being a midget.
Alrighty, so I have a few pieces of news. First off, Cineble. God, that's a problem with like having something on your, like a sore or cut on your tongue.
Give me sugar and water.
Like, it's okay for a little while, and then all of a sudden it just really screws you over.
I know, it rubs raw, and then it hurts to talk a certain way.
Yeah.
And it makes you sound, oh, no, dude, I've been there, man. I hear you.
What you say about my mama?
Cinema Blend is worried about the Terminator franchise. And according to one of their news articles, the caption of it reads, why Alan Taylor could mean bad things for the Terminator franchise. And they say, quote, few franchises have transformed as much over their lives as the Terminator films, which started with 1984's The Terminator as a slick, sci-fi-tinged thriller and eventually turned into 2010's Terminator Salvation, which involved a CGI Arnold Schwarzenegger and a robot heart transplant. The great leap into big-budget sci-fi happened under the capable guidance of James Cameron, who made Terminator 2 Judgment Day, the first great action film of the CGI era, and exponentially more successful than the original. When Cameron declined to make a third one, it was probably time to call it quits. But the last decade's two Terminator movies, Salvation, as well as Terminator 3 Rise of the Machines, have found diminishing returns, amping up the effects and fiddling even more with time travel. What started as a blazingly original sci-fi idea became a roided-up franchise dead set on competing against the big sci-fi spectacles it had inspired, while getting away from the clean narrative and flawless action filmmaking that made it work to begin with. Terminator 5, which has been talked up for the last 4 years, seemed headed in the same direction until 2011, when Megan Ellison's Annapurna Pictures picked up the rights to the series and hired Justin Lin to direct. In a few short years, Ellison has backed major directors like Paul Thomas Anderson and Kathryn Bigelow, and though Lin had helped the Fast and Furious franchise morph from dopey car races to massive spectacles, he did it with serious action chops and a constant awareness of the franchise's strengths. If anyone could continue Cameron's clean action style and unblinkered ambition, it could be Lin, with Ellison's pocketbook to back him up. Except now we have Alan Taylor, a veteran of many, many different TV shows whose star has risen significantly since working on Game of Thrones, a show of huge vistas, large-scale battles, and other tropes that translate well to the big screen. His Game of Thrones credentials made him a perfect choice for the grand-scale Thor: The Dark World, which comes to theaters in November. And they go on, they kind of elaborate more on this, so I'll just end the quote there. And I will ask, does that bode well for the Terminator sequel, or could this mean that it will be a, what they are worried about, a big, amped up, sci-fi, and more CGI, without really having a heart, soul, and storyline? Matt, if I remember correctly, didn't you like Terminator Salvation, but did not like Rise of the Machines?
No, I thought Rise of the Machines was okay.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely, it was a lot better than I thought it was going to be. But I apparently am the only one. I really enjoyed Salvation. I thought it was a great way to finally bridge the gap between the first one and everything you'd seen since. The thing was, is that I can't really say that it was intentional. It's hard for me to say, based on Titanic, based on Avatar, that it was intentional for heart and soul to be attached to the Terminator franchise in such a way that T2 did it. I really think that it was just force of nature. There were just the stars aligned in that regard. I'm not trying to take away anything from James Cameron. It is a fantastic movie. But I think people want T2 again, but none of the components are in place to do so. And I really think they just kind of need to let this thing be more organic. That's what I loved about Salvation, is that it did not, for once, it did not try to do Terminator, Terminator 2, or Rise of the Machines. It tried to be its own thing and tell its own story and kind of exist on its own. And I think it did very well doing that. That's why I liked that movie so much. The only thing that they did was this, was the young version of Arnold in CGI, which I personally thought was exceptionally clever. And I thought it was well done, but apparently, again, I'm the only one. Given everything you said, I don't know. I think if you're trying that damn hard, everybody's going to expect it, and then you're just setting them up. I say just back off, let them make a movie, and let's just see what happens. That totally didn't answer your question. I'm sorry.
No, it works. I'll counteract what you said just a little while ago with that. What made Terminator 1 and Terminator 2 was not the special effects and the storyline or the imaginativeness of it, but it was the characters. James Cameron has a thing for strong female characters. I mean, you'll get Ripley from Aliens. I mean, yeah, she was a strong character in the first movie, but she was even more of a stronger badass in the second movie. You look at True Lies, you see how Jamie Lee Curtis's character changes from a sheepish coward into a woman who has her shit together and goes out fighting. It's the same thing with Terminator 2, with Sarah Connor. And he did try to create a movie that was both good in all departments, visually appeasing, as well as you have the drama, you have the character, and you have the plot line, and you have all that good stuff. How I could see where this, the person who wrote this article, Katie Rich, with Terminator Salvation, with Rise of the Machines, it was all spectacle. Let's drive the story by action, opposed to with character and like with story itself. Yeah, Terminator 2 had car chases and cool special effects, but it was just done in such a modest way that the movie just completely worked together. And that's what I think kind of James Cameron did well. And no, you cannot replicate Terminator 2 with Terminator 3 or Terminator 4 or Terminator 5. You have to do your own thing. So I guess we will just have to see. Okay, my next bit of news comes from thedissolve.com. it brings up a interesting factoid about this here Van Diesel. Van Diesel? Must I mean Vin Diesel? And they say that if you're excited about Riddick, you have Tokyo Drift to thank. And apparently, according to this article, and according to what Vin Diesel came out and said, is that back when Tokyo Drift was made, I guess Universal knew that they had a franchise, you know, in hand, and that they wanted to do something to continue making these movies and hopefully kind of make something more well-rounded and something bigger to go off of. So they decided to bring in Vin Diesel as a little cameo at the end of Tokyo Drift to help drive the audience in wanting to see Fast and the Furious Part 4, or whatever the hell it was called. However, instead of receiving a lump sum of money, he asked for the rights of Riddick, the character of Riddick. And it just so happens that Universal agreed. And so they gave Vin Diesel Studio, One Race Production Company, they gave him the character of Riddick. So therefore he was able to make his dream project, which is Riddick. And I guess the reason why they gave it to him is because they knew that it would never become a huge franchise. Pitch Black didn't do that well at the movie theater. Chronicles of Riddick did not do that well at the movie theater. Well, there you go. Well, then Universal was probably wrong if that's what they thought, because Riddick made $18 million this past weekend, and, you know, hopefully it will make more money. I'm looking forward to seeing it. I'm going to try to go see it this weekend. So, yeah, that's the story of Vin Diesel. So, apparently, there was an original version of Ghostbusters Part 2, and this guy created a Kickstarter account because he wants to make a documentary about the unreleased, never-before-seen original version. And according to CinemaBlend.com, they say that, quote, it's been well-documented that this sequel happened when it did at the behest of Columbia Pictures, which wanted to capitalize on the success of the first film and the real Ghostbusters cartoon. The original script, written by Harold Ramis and Dan Aykroyd, was tossed for a new version closer to the one seen in the film, but there was still a lot of material left on the cutting room floor. This bungled process is a good bulk for the reason why Bill Murray hasn't been interested in returning to the franchise. Bjornstad aims to create Ghostbusters 2, The Original Vision, a documentary covering the entire pre-production process of the film, focusing on all the changes made from conception to the final product. He aims to make it as professional as possible and has the lofty goal of getting all the film's cast and crew involved for interviews. He also hopes to round up excerpts of the original script, storyboards, and behind-the-scenes photographs from the production. While it would be hard enough to get all the original material, it seems almost impossible for him to get Rick Moranis' interested, much less Murray, Ernie Hudson, and Dan Aykroyd, maybe. The reason why I'm stumbling on that, instead of it saying Rick Moranis, they have written here Rich Moranis, which has been throwing me off. End quote.
That's awesome.
He was wanting to get all the cut footage. I guess he's not really wanting to go through and create an original cut of the movie, but actually that'd be kind of cool. But he's wanting to do this documentary. And I gotta say, I think this would be a very interesting documentary, especially if there is enough material. And I really don't think we've ever seen a documentary, or actually a behind-the-scenes look, of the production problems and what all actually went into the making of Ghostbusters Part 2, to where some really enjoyed it, some did not like it for good reasons, I guess. But, of course, it was not as successful, and it was not nearly as great as the original movie. So, we will look forward to hopefully seeing this movie, Ghostbusters 2, The Original Vision, in the near future. But I do encourage you guys, if you have any cashola, this might be something to invest in, opposed to investing in your Spike Lee joints.
And now, I believe it is time for Three Square. Three Squared. All right, this time we are doing the films of Patrick Wilson.
Really our favorite films. And it turns out that while he is kind of coming into his own in terms of getting starring roles and what have you, I didn't want to use the two movies we've just been talking about, Insidious and The Conjuring. So the stuff we've got is pretty thin. He's in it. Don't get me wrong, he's in them, but they're small roles with the exception of two of the movies, one of which that Tim has, the other one that I have, and it wasn't even a theatrical movie, it was an HBO movie. So my three movies are going to be We'll start off with the HBO one.
Mom.
Joe?
Hi.
You're calling from the street. It must be 4 a.m. What's happened?
No, nothing. Nothing, I...
It's Harper. Has Harper... Come on. Joe? Joe?
Yeah, hi. No, Harper's fine. Well, no. She's not fine. How are you, Mom?
What's happened?
I just wanted to talk to you. I wanted to try something out on you.
Joe, you haven't... Have you been drinking, Joe?
Yes, ma'am. I'm drunk.
That isn't like you.
No. Well, I mean, who's to say?
Why are you out on the street? At 4 a.m?
In that crazy city. It's dangerous.
Oh, actually, I'm not on the street, Mom. I'm near the lake in the park.
What park?
Central Park.
Central Park? Oh, my Lord. What on earth are you doing in Central Park at this time of night?
Are you kidding? Joe, I think you ought to go home right now and call me from there.
Joe?
I come here to watch. Mom, sometimes. Just
to watch.
Watch what? What's there to watch?
Porn.
Mom, did Dad love me?
What?
Did he?
You have to go home now and call me from there.
No answer.
Oh, really? This is maudlin.
I don't like this conversation.
Yeah, well, it gets worse from here on.
Joe?
Mom? Mama? I'm a homosexual, Mama.
We're going to start off with Angels in America. It was a TV miniseries, but it's an HBO miniseries. It was adapted from the Pulitzer Prize-winning play of the same name by Tony Kushner. And basically, this is it's 1985. It's the height of Reaganomics and all that wonderful stuff. And this is the time that specifically AIDS was a plague, but only to gay men. This was a lot of controversies and stuff arose from this specific time period in terms to AIDS and HIV, but there was no denying that this was definitely afflicting gay men more than anybody else. And yet, it's telling the story of how AIDS in the 80s was affecting a few specific people and their families in some regards as well. We have a married couple where the husband is in the closet. He's got a boss, a political fixer, and he's in the closet as well. Then, of course, you have some out and proud people, but there's a couple, and one of them has AIDS, the other one does not. You know, it just turns out to be one of those things where it's just kind of a overarching story that takes place amongst a few different people and then how they all end up coming together over it. The miniseries, I watched it as soon as it came out. I'm pretty much willing to give anything, whether or not I think it's subject matter that I would normally care about. I don't care what it is. When HBO comes out with something big, 99.9% of the time, it's really good, so I always make a point to go see it. And this was the first time that I ever noticed Patrick Wilson. He actually plays Joe Pitt, and he happens to be a Mormon and a Republican attorney, but he is in the closet. His wife... They have a sexless marriage, naturally. His wife is actually played by Mary Louise Parker. And this was the first time that I ever remember seeing her full frontal nude. So, woo, yeah. She's strung out on Valium and stuff. But it's just really interesting to watch the dynamics that go on and to see how people struggle with their identities, whether people or not. And the interesting thing, especially in this particular dynamic, even though it's about a guy in the closet and then his wife, who was equally aware that there's a problem but hiding from it. It doesn't have to be, in this particular instance, of course, that's the subject matter of the miniseries. But what I liked about this relationship was that it showed just exactly how people always hide their deepest, darkest parts of themselves from their significant other. So few people are really willing to trust that person, to trust who they're with everything, with the darkest part of you. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be that you're lying about something or that you're not lying or that you're lying to yourself. It just goes to show that when you're not true to yourself and you're not true to your spouse or your significant other, it just exactly how poisonous that really is. And it was this particular relationship that really resonated with me throughout this whole thing. The rest of it was interesting. There was some pretty far out stuff going on because of angels. But it was that really caught me, and it was the first time that I ever noticed Patrick Wilson, and I had kind of put that in the memory banks there. So that's number one, Angels in America. Number two is a movie that, for me, it did just barely enough to not warrant a sequel. It was enough that they could have if they really wanted to, because especially when you factor in DVD Blu-ray sales, it would have pushed it over the edge for doubling its budget. But it's the A-Team. Yes, that's right. Patrick Wilson has a small role in this movie as Agent Vance Bress, a.k.a. Agent Lynch. But this was a movie, 2010 action American adventure thriller. It's the one that's based on the television series. And this is a movie that you just can't go wrong with when one of the most quotable lines is, "Oh my God, they're trying to fly the tank." I thought this movie was fantastic. I think I want to say that Tim and I have argued over this movie. I'm pretty sure that we did, more than likely with Tim landing on the opposite side of this fence.
I actually don't remember ever seeing A-Team.
Did we not do this one? Okay, I remember getting into an argument with somebody about it, but I thought it might have been you, because you're the only person I really argue with movies about.
If so, then I completely forgot about it.
Must have been that good. It was that good. It was that ingraining that, you know, you have completely dismissed it from your mind. But at any rate, for the main, the big heavy hitter stars here, it was Liam Neeson, Bradley Cooper, Quentin Jackson, Jessica Biel was in this one here. So I highly recommend this movie as all. And it just has the added bonus of you get to see some, more of Patrick Wilson in it as well. Last but not least for me is 2012's Prometheus. That's right. It's the Alien prequel brought to us by Ridley Scott here. Okay, he's got a really small part in this one. He basically is, in a flashback, he plays somebody's dad. I can't remember who it is. He's Shaw's father in Prometheus. It's Noomi Rapace's dad. As I said, this is basically kind of how we find out in the Alien universe where exactly it was that we came from. And, I really want there to be a sequel to this movie. There's got to be a sequel to this movie. This is a movie that did at most $130 million for a budget and brought in $403 million. Come on now. You know, we got to see how this thing turns out. Let's bring it on. Again, it's a really small part in this movie, and I admit that I was stretching here. But he was in it, by God. And I really look forward to what he's going to be doing next. I'm glad that Insidious 2 is going to be one of the movies we're watching. Oops, spoiler alert for the end of the show. I'm looking forward to more of his work. Long and the short of it, Patrick Wilson movies I find to be my favorite. Angels in America, the 2003 HBO miniseries. 2010's A-Team and 2012's Prometheus.
Well, geez. Why don't you just marry the guy, why don't you? God, you like him so much.
In today's age, I could. And if he was playing Joe Pitt, there's even more of a chance.
Wait, hang on. You're in Texas.
So?
How is that a possibility?
He's not in Texas.
Oh, so you would move with, you would go to him. That's awfully sweet. It's kind of cute. I can see you doing the slow motion running towards them, getting out of the car, and
there you
he
go.
Drops his coffee. And
of course, we'd have to do the completely overdone spoof thing where we run past each other. Open arms when we run past each other and follow. All right, go ahead, sir. What are your movies?
My three. These are pretty good movies. I will. I guess I will go through them with. You know, I guess my ultimate favorite will be the last one I mention. First off is 2006's Little Children with Kate Winslet as well as Patrick Wilson and Jackie Earle Haley, who plays a really creepy child molester, which it's creepy. And it's directed by Todd Field. And this is a movie about two people. They're in two different relationships. They're both unhappy with their lives. They're going nowhere career-wise. They're both stuck at home while their spouses are off doing their jobs and whatever, and they're just stuck at home taking care of their kids. And by chance, they happen to exchanging glances, and eventually that leads. One thing happens, and another thing happens, and the next thing you know, they have some lovemaking scenes. And with saying that, this movie features sex on the bed as well as sex on the dryer. So you can't really beat that. There's a lot to look at visually, which you can pretty much expect with any rated R movie that features Kate Winslet. Expect to see a lot of something. But it's also, it's a really good movie. It's a depressing movie. It's a sad movie. It plays very much like what would happen in real life. So it's always sad seeing two people that in some way are forced to cheat on their spouses so they can live a better life. But at the same time, you kind of understand why they're doing it because, for example, Kate Winslet's husband in the movie is a perverted jerk. It just kind of works out. Personally, I didn't think the movie was fantastic. I thought it was a little too long. It's over 2 hours and 10 minutes long. However, Patrick Wilson and Kate Winslet both give fantastic performances. My next movie is 2011's Young Adult.
Welcome to Hampton Inn. Do you have a reservation?
No.
Is that a dog in your bag?
Nope.
We actually allow small pets with a cleaning deposit.
Good, because I have a small dog in my vehicle.
What are you doing back in Mercury? Or you move back, or?
Of course not. Gross.
Psychotic prom queen bitch. Down on the
street. Here's the deal. Buddy Slade and I are meant to be together, and I'm here to get him back.
I'm pretty sure he's married with a kid on the way.
No, kid's here. I'm cool with it. I mean, I've got baggage, too.
I would keep all of this to yourself. I would find a therapist.
That new baby of his is just darling.
Have you seen it? Up close?
Can I help you find something?
I'm going to a rock concert with an old flame.
Let's show him what he's been missing.
No, he's seen me recently. He knows. But his wife hasn't seen me in a while, so.
You can come to the city with me like we always planned.
Mavis, I'm a married man.
No, we can beat this thing together.
Patrick Wilson is obviously the guy that she is madly in love with, practically obsessed with. However, I like how he plays it. He's not a douchebag. He's not an asshole. He's in love with his wife. He's in love with his kid. And other than this one specific moment in the movie, which I do not want to give away, he plays it straight. He plays it like a normal guy, just a regular Joe, I guess. And I appreciate it. He's just very entertained watching the movie. And the movie itself is actually really good. So check it out. Again, that's Young Adult. And my third and final Patrick Wilson movie, and it happens to be one of my favorite movies of all time, and that is Zack Snyder's 2009 Frank Miller comic adaptation, Watchmen.
We need to squeeze people.
Sure. Why don't we just pick names out of a phone book?
You forgot how we do things, Daniel. You've gone too soft, too trusting, especially with women.
Okay, no, listen, I've had it with that. God, who do you think you are, Rorschach? You live off people while insulting them, and no one complains because they think you're a damn lunatic. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that, man.
Daniel. You are a good friend.
You know, it's that really cool superhero movie about all those cool superheroes in an alternative 1980s where Ronald Reagan is still the president of the United States and these guys are trying to thwart a possible attack of a nuclear explosion in New York City. Patrick Stewart,
Helm, Warp 1, engage!
Plays Dan Drybird, and of course he is the character of Night Owl. And what I really liked about this movie is that he actually keeps his head on his shoulders throughout the entire movie. He doesn't necessarily freak out. He sees things clearly. He doesn't go bonkers by the end of the movie like a number of the other characters and all the other superheroes kind of eventually do. He's a pretty stable guy, and it is because of him that you think that there is hope. At the end of the movie, everything will turn out to be all right. And it's how he communicates, his outview on life, his outview on the future. He's not a pessimistic fellow. He's just trying to devote his life into making the city and making the world a better place. And within doing that, he's having to deal with this impending doom, as well as all these other characters that are kind of just adding fuel to the fire. He's always been the one that was there trying to keep things on track. And he just fit the character well. He portrayed the character well. All in all, he added to what is already, I think, a fantastic movie. And I couldn't see anybody else play that character. So, again, those are my three favorite movies of Patrick Wilson: Little Children, Young Adult, and finally, Watchmen.
Well, then I guess there's nothing left for us to do but the news!
You mean...
The movies! I'm so fucking out of it, dude. I'm sorry. That's terrible. Let's try that again. Oh my god, I can't believe I said that.
We're almost there. Okay. Alright,
excellent job, sir. Alright, I guess there's nothing left for us to do but the movies! Yes, the movies. Okay, we've got three movies this week. The Grandmaster. Which, of because, you know, we're cool people and we're into the scene, we were able to watch the original 130-minute Chinese edit of the film. So that's what we're going to be talking about today in terms of that one. We will not be reviewing the American version, which is, Tim, what did you say it was again? 149?
Cut out about 22 minutes.
Okay, so it's about an hour 49 there. The other two movies we had were from Netflix. We had It's a Disaster and With Nail and I. All right, where do you want to go first, sir?
Let's go with It's a Disaster.
Which, incidentally, it was not. And yet it is. This was probably one of the funniest movies I think I've ever seen. I like black comedy.
I'm glad you said that because I was worried, because I turn out to really love this movie as well.
Stop picking
so good,
movies.
I'm glad
if you're so worried, start picking movies you think I'll like and you hate. That would probably be a good turning point there. Man, I'm so worried I'm going to hate this movie. I'll bet you Matt's going to like it. Let's pick that one. That should be your thought right there.
I want us to be joined together in peace and harmony in the realm of movie watching.
Ah, but do the listener.
Oh, well, do we actually care about the listener? Oh, I guess we do.
The
I'm
listener?
Kidding.
Yes, we care about the listener.
The listener. Oh god, I gotta quit doing that, listeners. I'd be optimistic.
No. But seriously, I mean, seriously, no. This movie really is funny. I wasn't quite sure exactly what I was gonna make of it when I first saw this movie. It's a Disaster. It's a 2012 black comedy, and it's written and directed by Tom Berger. It stars Rachel Boston, David Cross, America Ferrera, Jeff Grace, Aaron Hines, Julia Stiles, Todd Berger, tons of people. It's kind of an interesting flick about the end of the world. Think this is the end, but without the dick jokes. Take a listen.
Lexi is Peter's wife.
Lexi is Buck's wife. Buck's Emma wife. Is Pete's wife.
Okay, yes. All right.
Oh. Hi.
Okay. Hi, Ann.
Hi.
Where'd you and Tracy meet?
Online.
No shame in that. That's where we found our vet.
That's great. That's really good.
Yeah, it'll help you get through this.
I'm sorry, what? Hey, who's this other guy in the picture with Tracy?
That's, Brett? No, that's Roger.
Oh, that is Roger.
Emma's moving out.
Why?
Why?
Ah, because we're getting a divorce.
I thought you wanted to wait until the end of brunch.
You guys haven't heard?
Heard what?
That a bunch of dirty bombs were set off downtown?
What's a dirty bomb, bro?
Is anyone infected?
Infected with what?
With whatever's out there.
But we don't know what's out there.
And that's exactly what's scaring me.
Put some clothes on.
Why bother, man? Let's go out the way we came in.
We're all gonna be dead in like 3 hours. We're not gonna last out here.
Well, maybe you should learn to show up to things on time, huh?
Things are gonna degrade very quickly.
Okay, no, okay, perfect!
The rules of society are gonna break down. your life is going to be in the hands of the people you can trust.
Ta-da!
Do you have any weapons? Guns, mace, crossbows?
Oh.
What?
Well, it was building to the big finale and you just cut it off right before it ended.
Oh, God, I'm sorry.
Let's have a party?
Brunch.
Guess I missed my invite.
All right, so we have a group of people who have come together for a couple's brunch that has definitely been stagnating for quite some time, and now because of all of the intricacies within all these different relationships, it's more or less they kind of, I don't know that they necessarily hate each other, but it is really just, it's totally awkward, which lends itself to great amounts of comedy. And then, of course, they go to try and figure out what's going on with a particular sporting event, and then all of a sudden they realize that there's no communication at all. You don't, there's no TV, there's no internet, there's no phone, there's nothing, not even a landline. And through the course of the movie, as they're fighting amongst themselves and arguing and discussing things or whatever, they eventually figure out that a chemical attack has happened, and now, oh my god, what are they going to do? But of course, they still have to deal with everything themselves, and so all of the tension, all the awkwardness, all this, the various scenarios that have worked out between them over the years, they're working through that while they're trying to find solutions to this problem, which then just makes it funnier and funnier and funnier until it builds up to the very, very end of the movie that I'm not going to tell you what happens. This was just a good movie. This was definitely easily a 4.5-star movie for me. The only thing was just a few parts where it kind of drags a little bit, but there's just no way you can sustain that kind of funny, especially in a black comedy, without having some lulls in it. But it seemed to me that these people definitely had a blast making this movie, and it translates into you enjoying watching this movie. That's all I have to say. This is a 4.5-star movie for me. I loved it. I'm glad you picked it. And what do you have to say, sir? David Cross is hilarious, by the way, as always.
Yeah, definitely. I thought David Cross was going to be the best character in this entire movie. However, each character was completely different, and each character kind of had their own share in the spotlight throughout the movie, where, like, Julia Stiles was hysterical. Oliver, I mean, it's just everybody was just really good in this movie. And right off the bat, where I knew that this was going to be a perfect, or at least nearly a near-perfect comedy, was that the humor at the very beginning of the movie, and completely from way out in left field. Like, I just totally didn't see that coming. And I don't know if it's because there are not many witty comedies like that. I mean, like a comedy that doesn't rely on dick jokes, fart jokes, or how many interesting, fun, fascinating ways can a character say fuck or any other vulgarity to make it funny. But it relies on awkward moments, witty humor, witty dialogue, true life thoughts and situations that go on. I mean, just some of the things that these people were saying, my friends have told me that, or I've said that to my friends, or we've had conversations about that, or we didn't have conversations about this. You know, it was just, like, it's hard to explain that the movie just works.
How you holding up?
You know, I never went to Europe. Never. Not once. I never even went to Montreal, which I hear is very European. I never went scuba diving. I never went to the ballet. I've never been in love. I've never even watched The Wire.
All of those things are overrated. Except for The Wire, that's really good. The last season's not very good, but Montreal, come on.
I'm blaming it on the tongue that I can't find the words to describe the joy that I experienced while watching this movie. But I guess the one negative but positive thing about this movie, because it, you know, it's on the verge of being, you know, something bad, but it completely saves itself every single time, is that this movie almost hits a wall. It almost gets a little awkward, it almost gets weird, or it almost goes into a direction, kind of like, you, I mean, I'm sure you've watched movies where you like the movie, but then it verges off the beaten path a little too much, to where the movie cannot return. Well, this movie almost kind of does that. It kind of sticks its foot off the path a little bit. But then it just brings you right back in. And it takes that moment and creates something completely different from that. And that's just something that I really appreciated and that I really liked. And I'm just going to stop it right there before I just ramble on and on and on.
Okay. With Nail and I, probably one of the most quotable movies I have heard in a long time. Everything from tons of Hamlet being thrown out there, slings and arrows, outrageous fortune, to other quotes that, you know, oh, he went to the other place, and things about carrots and centerpieces of cauliflower, or floral arrangements of cauliflower. Various mentions of carrots, and of course, things along the lines of,
don't get uptight with me, mate. Because if you do, I'll have to give you a dose of medicine. And if I spike you, you'll know you've been spoken to.
You wouldn't spike me. You're too mean. Besides, there's nothing invented I couldn't take.
If I medicined you, you'd think a brain tumour was a birthday present.
I could take double anything you could.
Very, very foolish words, man.
And of course, the classical naming of the Camberwell carrot. I was even more worried about this movie than I was about It's a Disaster. But I was, once again, laughing my ass off through the whole movie. And yet, at the same time, I really, really liked how the movie ended. It's a 1987, again, black comedy, but this one takes place in 1969. It takes place in, basically, in Camden Town, for the most part. They end up in what's known as the Lake District. Aside from that, it's basically just these guys' misadventures over the course of a weekend. And they are out-of-work actors, but basically, they refer to themselves as resting. But they're basically just glorified bums living on welfare, searching for any and all form of libation possible. Nail decides to take advantage of I, who in the production of the published screenplay is referred to as Marwood, but you don't ever know that unless you do a little bit of research. They decide to go and hit up with Nail's gay uncle to go and get his place in the country for the weekend, thinking it'll do a little bit of good. And then, of course, misadventures happen all over the place, including poor I, or as I said, Marwood, is getting hit on in one of the best room-switching scenes ever. I mean, it's Benny Hill all over the place. They needed Yakety Sax playing for the most part. And yet, the movie has a very underlying seriousness about it, and it's very subtle because you can kind of see it build from different angles. It's very much akin to The World's End in terms of when I was referring to kind of that you can't go home again, there's got to be a time to grow up kind of thing. That there's this kind of soft undertone through the whole movie that where this is happening. And you kind of see it in one character where you don't see it in another. I'm not going to tell you who it is because I don't want to spoil it for you. This is a definite movie that you have just got to see. The ending is poignant. It's perfect. It's just an outstanding movie. I'm not a big fan of the cinematography. It was shot in the 80s but done in a 60s style, late 60s, early 70s style, which I think was done on purpose, but I wasn't impressed with that effect of it. So it does kind of make the movie feel old in that regard. But you want to dismiss that so that you can focus on the characters. Focus on the writing. That's where this movie comes alive. And as a result, 5 stars. 5 freaking stars on this movie. It was fantastic. Absolutely loved it. Yeah, outstanding. I can't say enough good things about it. Also, if you are a fan at all of Richard Griffiths, and for those in the here and now, he was most recently Vernon Dursley, mean old Uncle Vernon Dursley in the Harry Potter movies. You gotta check him out. This was definitely him in his prime.
Yeah, this is another one that I cannot say too many good things about this movie. It's funny, it's sweet, it's charming. A variety of characters, therefore you have a variety of dialogue for your ears to feast on, maybe? Feast on the lush sound of witty British banter and humor. And a couple weeks ago, I went and saw this movie at the New Beverly Cinema, because Edgar Wright was curating that season, the season of the movies, and he was saying the reason why he picked that movie was because The World's End, there was kind of like a sense of that you can never go back home, that you need to grow up, that you can never like revisit your past, or you can never revisit your prime. And that's where he kind of got, if you guys have seen The World's End, or even listen to our review of it, you'll kind of get what I'm talking about. Whereas Simon Pegg's character was living in the past. He was wanting to get his buddies together and redo a pub crawl in the same drunken, goofy, out-of-control fashion that they did 20-some-odd years before. And, of course, it doesn't quite happen the same way, and it doesn't turn out well at all. In this movie, you kind of look at these characters, I guess, in their heyday of thinking that they're invincible, thinking that they are right. The narrator, he's a little bit more optimistic. He's getting sick and tired of where he is in life. He wants to succeed. He wants to become an actor. He wants to have roles. He wants to have money. He wants to be able to do things that he wants to do. However, when he's with Nell, he's lured in back into the drinking, debauchery-filled lifestyle that they live on in. So whenever they decide to go to the cabin, he's just kind of riding with Nell's coattails. And I think what really pushed him, kind of got him there, pushed him over the edge, is when his Uncle Vernon came over and decided to spend a couple nights with him in his cabin and starts getting a little frisky with I. And of course, and all that leads up to the ending of the movie, which I will, you know, I won't say anything about. And I will not say anything else about the movie, because the ending is absolutely perfect. And it's just what works completely. It's what should have happened. Very quotable. And there's not really much I could add to it. I thought the filming of it, the shooting of it, was just how a lot of British movies were. And they probably haven't gone through and cleaned the film and tried to maybe like redigitize it or play with the color a little bit to make it look a little bit better. Because this movie was underfunded when the movie was being made. And it was actually up to George Harrison. After he read the screenplay, he agreed to actually fund whatever that still needed some more money.
All right, Chair.
What do you want?
Cake. All right, Chair.
No, we're closing in a minute.
We're leaving in a minute. One. Cake and tea.
Didn't you hear? She said she'd closed. What do you want in here?
Cake. What's it got to do with you?
I happen to be the proprietor. Now, would you leave?
Ah, I'm glad you're the proprietor. I was going to have a word with you anyway. We're working on a film up here. Location, see? We might want to do a film in here.
You're drunk.
Just bring out the cake. Cake and fine wine.
If you don't leave, we'll call the police.
Balls. We want the finest wines available to humanity. We want them here, and we want them now.
Miss Brenner has it. Telephone the police.
It's all right. Miss Brenner has it. I'm warning you. If you do, you're fired. We are multi-millionaires. We shall buy this place and fire you immediately. Yes, we'll buy this place. And we'll install a fucking jukebox in here. Liven all you stiffs up a bit.
The police, Miss Brenner, has it. Just say there are a couple of drunks in the Penrith tea rooms and we want them removed.
We are not drunks. We are multi-millionaires.
Awesome. Very good, very good. Well, then, here we are. We're down to the last, the end, the Grandmaster. All right, now this here is the 2013 Hong Kong Chinese martial arts film that's based on, or drama film, sorry, we've got to make sure it's other than martial arts drama film, and it is based on Ip Man. Now, of course, we've talked about Ip Man, Ip Man 2, the fact that his claim to fame in terms of why he's internationally known today is more related to the fact that he was the guy that taught Bruce Lee, and of course, we tie all that into Bruce Lee, but let's not forget this guy was, you know, a legend in China. So quite a few billion people know about him more than the few hundred million of us out here that do. Actually, you know, we should probably just go ahead and let the trailer speak for itself.
Kung Fu, 2个字, 一横一直.
Oh,
wait, It's in Chinese. Don't worry about it. Okay, so here's what's up. This is basically kind of picking up where Ip Man was kind of the story of Ip Man growing up, and then Ip Man 2 was kind of his eminent arrival to Hong Kong and how he kind of established himself there. The Grand Master kind of takes a dramatic tone starting at the time that Japan invaded, more or less, within about a year of Japan invading. I think this is one of those movies that, I don't know, I think the story is really interesting, and they tried to take a drama, a good drama, a solid drama, and then blend the martial arts into it, and I think that tends to be somewhat misleading, because the way that they're trying to market this film here in America is as another Ip Man kick-ass kind of movie. That's not what this movie's about, though. This movie is about the human relationships that existed in Ip Man's world, and it doesn't just focus on him. They also bring in a few of his competitors who were also teachers of various styles of martial arts, including, according to the movie, like the one person who ever beat him, which is this woman by the name of Yong Er. And yet, they kind of underdevelop her character. She plays kind of this integral role to the style of the story and the message of the story, which is always about unification. And I'm kind of like starting to wonder if that's more just Communist Party line that they have to put into these movies or not. I don't know. And yet she's always, it's kind of like she's seeking to destroy that unification for her own means. And it kind of confuses the movie in that regard. And it, for me, it kind of takes away from the story of Ip Man and the interesting way that it tells it. But they do a lot of really cool things, a lot. The use of color, as always, is amazing. It's kind of become like almost like a mainstay ever since Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. It's the same style of use of color. The one thing that I am kind of getting tired of in these movies is the overabundance of the wire work, especially when it comes to movies like this. This is a movie that's trying to tell the dramatic story of a person. So it's fine if you want to blend in the martial arts aspect of this man's life, because it did play such a unique part in his life and a large part in his life. But you don't need to make it so showy, because it just further adds to the confusion of what kind of movie you're trying to watch.
Exactly. And it's obvious whenever you see a person start falling back and then you can see them getting shot up by a wire, pulling them like across a room every time he kicks somebody.
And it's from the very beginning of the movie that this happens. Now, again, we are talking about the Chinese edit. This is the 130-minute Chinese edit of this movie. We're not going to pretend to tell you that it's the same thing that's in the American edit. As a matter of fact, if some of these things that we're discussing are not as prevalent, we would love to hear that. Ooh, look at that. Now you got to tell us. Now you have to tell us. I think I've got to give this movie overall 3.5 stars. This is a solid effort. I think that, for me, this is probably one of the most unique dramas that I've ever seen. I'm going to let it stand as a drama movie. I was expecting this to be more American spectacle because of the way that I had initially thought of it myself. I thought this was supposed to be more, they were taking Ip Man 2 and putting it in more of an American package. Well, and I think that's what the Weinsteins were trying to do with the edit that they made. Not having seen that edit, I won't make any comment to that regard. This particular movie, though, is definitely drama. There is martial arts to this movie, but it is a drama. And again, 3.5 stars. I think I've said all I need to say. Good performances by people you haven't ever heard of. Except for Zhang Ziyi. I apologize if I'm bringing it up. I have seen her before, but I don't remember where. I know I've seen her before. But other than that,
Rush Hour 2?
Is that what it was? Okay.
We could have been a good couple. We could have had something special. But you one crazy ass bitch.
Yeah.
So there you go. All right, so there you go. 3.5 stars for me. What do you think, Tim?
I'm in the same boat. What exactly is this movie trying to be? That's what I kept asking myself throughout the entire 2 hour and 10 minute running time. Because in this movie, you have the drama. You have the story of Ip Man. And the guy who plays him is totally convincing. And his story itself is fantastic, and I did not know anything about the history of him before seeing this movie. So I was completely taken by surprise, and I was completely in awe. In fact, I would like to learn more about him. So that part of the movie is pretty cool. However, how this movie is shot and how this movie plays out with these kind of random, it feels like at times forced fight scenes, because not only do you have the obvious wire work, but then you have the slow motion fighting, where the slow motion fighting will focus on, like they at the beginning of the movie, they have a fight in rain, and just pouring down rain, and he punches a guy, and you can just hear and see his fist punching every single droplet of rain that is in its path. There's just really no point. Well, I mean, it's cool to look at, yes, but after maybe the fifth time you see that happening within like a 20-minute time frame, it gets a little bit repetitive, and it kind of takes away the surprise aspect. You have nothing to look forward to, really, because it's kind of like that same gimmick throughout the entire movie. Obviously, of course, when the whole dramatic aspect is going on. But however, even though when there is drama, when the character is kind of just like looking at another character or looking off in the distance, or when something ominous is going on, they still rely on the slow motion with the dramatic music swelling in the background with the narration going on. Itman's narration. It gets a little bit melodramatic and a little bit repetitive again, to where you just kind of expect that with every single scene. And every single fight scene kind of starts off the same way. Somebody gives the other person a look, or somebody drops something, or somebody like throws a punch and then somebody blocks it and then it goes on from there. It's just kind of like the same thing. You know, again, there's not a whole lot of surprises in the movie. The Matrix kept popping in my head while watching the movie. How the fight scenes were stylized with the cinematography, what the camera focused on, where the actors ended up, how they landed on things, and how it looked like they floated in the air. And I'm pretty sure some of that stuff was relished to the extreme, because it looked like, I mean, obviously with camera tricks and whatnot, but it gave the illusion that these people were kind of floating and jumping really high. It just looked a lot more fictional and fantastical than believable. And since this movie is a drama, not an action movie at all, but it's definitely a drama, I just wanted to see something that was more realistic, something to me that was a little more true. We didn't need the crazy camera effects. We didn't need all these cool editing techniques and the quick cuts and the zoom-ins and the slow motions. That, you know, just leave that for the big budget action CGI movies. With this kind of movie, this is what you don't need. What I read from CinemaScope.com after watching the movie, I was kind of looking up some stuff about it. The writer, and I can't remember the guy's name, but it was the guy from CinemaScope that reviewed the movie, and he said something that I thought was poignant and to me spoke true about where this movie really fails throughout the story opposed to the special effects. And I'm saying that this movie didn't completely fail. I thoroughly enjoyed it and definitely kept my attention. But I agree with this guy from CinemaScope where he says that the movie is extremely loyal to the history as well as the genre, but it hurts the movie. And this ties into what I've been saying. The genre, kung fu, martial arts, the history, the life of Ip Man, they're blending a martial arts movie with an incredible true story. And that's where the movie falters. Some of the pros about this movie is that there are great performances, moving performances. I felt sorry for the guy, especially the whole outcome between him and his wife. But this movie definitely stands out from anything I've seen from China within the martial arts realm. Wonderfully shot. The performances are great. Some of the dramatic scenes are borderline melodramatic, kind of like an old-fashioned 1940s, 1950s, where they relied a lot on a beautiful score and the random tear going down a character's eyes to show that this is a heartbreaking scene, that the audience should be heartbroken as well for the character. But with a lot of other movies, that's hammy, but with this movie, it kind of works. And one scene in particular where this works is one of the last scenes between Ip Man and the daughter of the elder, Long Er, where they have the discussion about life is an opera. It's just very old-fashioned, very melodramatic. It's a heartbreaking scene. And to me, that was one of the main driving forces of this movie. Especially, it's just seeing these two characters, though it wasn't a falling in love relationship per se, it was appreciation between the two. I mean, she was the only people that has ever beaten Ip Man, and so they have some kind of bond. And though it is a strange bond, and it's not as a bond that Americans, that you and I would consider as a strong, passionate bond, a friendship, but for some reason in the whole Chinese mythology, it all makes completely sense within that context. The characterization and how these people relate to each other is to me what ultimately makes this movie totally worth watching, as well as the story itself. And despite for a lot of the nitpicky things and the things that I don't want to say ragged on, but brought up about this movie, this is still a 3.5 out of 5-star movie. It is still definitely enjoyable. I enjoyed it because it's just such an involving movie, as well as an invigorating, unbelievable tale about this guy. It's just wonderful. But with saying that, it's kind of sad to think that apparently the Weinsteins cut out most of that relationship between Ip Man and the elder's daughter. Yeah, they felt that was something that they wanted to cut because it would tighten the movie. Yeah, so I'm kind of glad we watched the extended edition of this movie. And if you're the director, Wong Kar-wai, and this is according to twitchfilm.com, where they say, quote, Wong Kar-wai, the director, recently told the Wall Street Journal that, quote, the U.S. version is more straightforward and linear. The Chinese audience is more interested in experiencing the history. In the U.S., it's more about the story. I took it as a challenge. Instead of doing a short version, I wanted to do a new version. I wanted to tell the story in a different way. And it goes on to say, like, the actors are publicly supporting the U.S. cut. Tony Leung says that he thinks that it's wise for him to do a version for Americans. It's much easier for them to follow. Zhang Ziyi added, in my opinion, I like the American one. It's clearer, easier for foreigners. And then further down the article, this is where they get to exactly more so what they say that they cut out. Again, twitchfilm.com, quote, the U.S. cut keeps the action sequences, but drops some of the key dramatic elements that made the 130-minute version special by changing up the mood, pacing, and focus. Wong Kar-wai has indeed succeeded in creating a more straightforward and linear movie, but now it tells a story we've heard and seen before, and nothing more, without the distinctive touches that made the longer version much more than a run-of-the-mill, slowly paced martial arts flick. End quote. The author of this article was disappointed by the U.S. version. He thought that this was more so like what he calls the Grandmaster Light, and not the full story. So, I look forward to when we can actually see the cut one, and maybe we can do a nice little masterpiece discussion over these movies.
Well, maybe we will. Only time will tell. Time that will not be edited out by the Weinstein Company. All right. So, next week's movies. Actually, first of all, next week's 3 Squared. Well, actually, I'm sorry. 3 Squared in 2 weeks is actually going to be our favorite quotable movies. So these are going to be the 3 movies that Tim and I find to be the most quotable. And who knows, with Nail and I just might make that list for both of us. We shall see. We shall see. The movies, and again, that's going to be in 2 weeks, because next week we have our masterpiece discussion, where we discuss Matt Lurker's article on movies that, for him, are way too long. We discuss whether or not he's right, he's wrong, or whether or not anybody should be making these kinds of judgments or not. That kind of flies in the face of what this show's about, but hey, we do what we want, damn it. Next up on the show for the movies-wise, we are going to be looking up Insidious Chapter 2, The Family, and 52 Pickup. I know Tim already stated that he's going to try and watch Riddick. I believe I'm going to try and watch it too. That is that. I think we're down to just the spiel, right?
Spiel on.
Alrighty, alrighty. Okay, the music you've been listening to, as always, is provided to us by our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can check them out at criesofsolace.com. You can also check them out at myspace.com, reverbnation.com, and facebook.com/criesofsolace. And of course, we are still the SLS cast, and you can check us out at slscast.com. You can send us an email to theslscast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at theslscast. Go to Facebook and look up the SLS cast there. You can even subscribe to us on iTunes. And until next time, this is Matt saying that thanks to Sam Neill, I get to say this. People turn into fools when they see a movie star and do weird things.
I believe it. And this is Tim saying that next week I will discuss and tell you why and how I actually enjoyed the movie R.I.P.D. Cheers, guys.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.